Hello, everyone. Welcome to Shockit Presents Movie Night. I'm your host. My name is Rudy Obias. Joining me for this episode, he's a writer for CineAwesome.com and also CriterionCast.com, James McCormick. Thank you so much for joining me on this episode.
Thank you for having me.
So the movie that we're going to be talking about in this episode, one of the big movies coming out actually this Wednesday, I believe, is the new film from Martin Scorsese, Hugo. Which is based on a novel. And this is actually Scorsese's first film that he's made that is a children's film, if I'm correct in thinking that.
Yeah, it is actually. It's crazy.
And it's also his first movie that is done 3D. And this movie takes place in the early 30s in Paris, post World War I. And is about a little boy named Hugo who lives in a train station and who he's kind of in charge of making sure the clocks run on time. James, what are your thoughts on Hugo? Did you see this type of film as a good entry into following Martin Scorsese's career? Does this fit in with movies like Goodfellas and Casino?
Well, I mean, I think it's Scorsese just again showing his love of cinema, especially in this one. This is like the love affair he has with the original, you know, fathers of cinema. You have mentions of various people. They show little clips throughout the film, which I dig. You and I joked afterwards where it was like, is this movie actually for kids per se, or for like the grown-ups that are going with those kids? And I think it's for both. Like, it's a little bit of everything, and I think it fits up. Like, I mean, I want to see this again, like ASAP, like when it comes out. I want to see it. I want to bring people to it, people that don't know about these types of films. And also, I mean, Scorsese shows that he understands 3D also. Like, I was surprised about that, because, you know, some filmmakers, oh, I'm going to do a 3D film, and you go, oh, okay, was there a need for it? In this film, it feels like it's just part of the story. It's not in your face, but there's some scenes that are amazing. Or, I mean, the one scene that actually choked me up was when you see the ashes of what he believes is his book that has been burnt, and it's falling at you, you know, like the actual audience. And I'm like, wow, see, that's a good use of 3D. It's not just like, look at this, and like throwing it at you, yeah. You know.
And also, like, since it takes place during the wintertime in Paris, there's a lot of snow, and the way the snow falls throughout the whole movie, It's just, it feels like it's falling on the audience. And I agree, this is really a good use of 3D, which I was surprised with, because Scorsese has never done a 3D movie, but it feels like he has a greater understanding of the technology than some, even James Cameron, I would say. Like you, James, I was kind of shocked with this movie. I didn't think that Scorsese could pull off a children's film. He's a very violent filmmaker. He's a great filmmaker, but also a very violent one. And so for me, going into this movie, I thought Scorsese was kind of slumming it in a way. Like, oh, he just wanted to make a big money-making movie.
Right.
Quite the opposite. This definitely has that same sure hand of every Scorsese film, and this feels like a Scorsese film. And it's funny that I brought up the movies Goodfellas and Casino on purpose. Well, namely Goodfellas, because to me, when I first saw this movie, the beginning of it kind of feels like Goodfellas. It starts off with this little boy Hugo looking down at the train station from ostensibly his room, this clock tower, and seeing everyone interact with each other. And you get this impression that he can't be part of that world, just like at the beginning of Goodfellas, you know?
Yeah.
And so I thought that was pretty cool, like homage to Scorsese himself with that. This movie is delightful. Like you, I'm not sure if kids will like this as much as adults, because it is a slow burning film. And I believe it is over 2 hours long, and I don't know if kids are going to have that kind of attention span. But from what I understand from critics that I've talked to who have children, they said that their kids love this movie, that they were with this movie from beginning to end. and they didn't feel restless at all while watching it. It's funny, when children watch it, they gravitate to the character of Hugo, but when adults watch it, they gravitate towards Ben Kingsley's character. And that's what I find so refreshing with this film. Scorsese uses 3D not only to immerse the viewer into the movie, which he does very well, but I also think that Scorsese is making a comment on 3D. Namely, this movie, there's a lot of like dawn of cinema type of movies in this movie. Mm-hmm. And I found it pretty interesting. There's a part of this movie when they say, well, film is just it's a gimmick. It's going to go away in 5 years. No one's going to really take it seriously. You can say the same thing about 3D, right? Like, right. When that comes out, a lot of people still think it's just a gimmick. It's not going to be around in 5 years. I feel Scorsese is making a comment on 3D doing it this way.
Oh, definitely. I mean, I think with a director like, you know, Scorsese, he did it right. And he shows, like, look, this is what you can do with 3D. You know, you might think all these other films that have it that are, you know, upconverted and stuff are just a fad. And you know what? I hope that's the fad. And I hope that when you know, not every film is going to be in 3D. I wouldn't want that. But I want films to look like this in 3D, where you just feel like you're part of the scenery. You're looking around and you're just seeing this master just play with the camera. Like, you could tell Scorsese, at least in my opinion, had a lot of fun making this film because he was trying new things. Like, one, a kid's film. Two, he got to poke, you know, like basically relive like George Méliès, you know, his film career in a short amount of time and showcase it, and showing like the old cameras and the old projectors, and just, I mean, that stuff alone was just beautiful. And like, it's to me, you know, smart kids, you know, kids that go into this and then actually get something from it will want to see these films, because wow, they were making films in like the, like over 100 years ago. Yes, they were. Like, and this guy was one of the fathers of film, and you should respect it. And that's really what Scorsese is showing in this film. Like, if it wasn't for these people, would we have film today? You know, and that's really what I get from this film. Like, it's just a beautiful homage to that, but also to an artist who feels like he's been forgotten and, you know, left behind, but yet unknown to him, people are obsessing over his work, and it's just waiting to be loved again. And that's kind of like, I think, what Scorsese is doing again for him and original film. He's showing the love and like, look, let us never forget where it began, because it's still amazing work. And, you know, if you could look at that and, you know, oh, the special effects aren't good. Yeah, you know why? Because it's 1896, you know, like, it's 1901. They were inventing special effects. They were inventing ways to film. And, you know, it still amazes me, like, when you see him throwing his head up and his head is, like, just appearing above. Yeah. That's great stuff. And I think kids can get something from that. So a young kid might be amazed at seeing, like, guys dressed up like lobsters and stuff, you know, but, like, how they would make someone disappear, and they actually show you. It's a behind-the-scenes look, yeah, but also a nod.
Well, also, it's in that respect that there were no rules of filmmaking like there are now, like how to mm-hmm. do stuff like that. So they had to figure it out on the fly. And I too love that, those behind-the-scenes, like how they actually shot, or actually how they pulled that off, you know. These old, like, 1902 films, and I bet Scorsese was kind of geeking out that he had to, you know, recreate all of that for this movie. The performances in this movie, Sacha Baron Cohen is in this movie. We might know him as Borat and Bruno, and this is also kind of a strange thing that he's in this children's film. James, what are your thoughts on the performance of Sacha Baron Cohen as the station inspector?
Yeah, I you know, going into it, when I saw the trailers, he just looked, to me personally, he looked like a bumbling idiot, which is what I was expecting going in. And he's actually much more than that. At first, you know, he looks like he has like the quirks, you know, like an original, you know, silent film star, where, you know, he has like one leg that's like all kind of weird and like can't move correctly because of the war, and it has like, you know, little like gears on it. And but then you actually learn more, like, little things about him throughout. Like, you know, he's not just this angry one-note character. He likes the girl who sells the flowers, and he really wants to ask her out, but he's awkward, and he can't even smile. And that's a great little running joke throughout, like yeah. from when it starts to the end. It's like he doesn't know how to smile.
He has the worst smile imaginable. And he gives it three tries, too, and it's still pretty bad. Yeah, I love Sacha Baron Cohen in this movie. He was very funny. Just definitely a breath of fresh air. He's funny in a different way than what we would get in Borat or Bruno. And actually, I feel he's definitely fit for this type of role. I love one of my favorite running gags that was part of the station inspector was his phone calls to the police chief talking about the police chief's wife who left him. I found those scenes pretty hilarious, actually.
Yeah, those are pretty brilliant. Like, without ruining for anybody, it's just runs throughout, and like how this guy wants his wife back, and just their comment. Even when they meet up to take one of the kids away to the orphanage, they keep that conversation going, and it keeps going in person, on the phone, and yeah, I especially like it when you don't hear the other side, because you have to only imagine what the hell is this. The chief saying to him, like, about his wife and why she's left him, or she's pregnant, like, and there's a funny joke about that. And yeah, Sacha Baron Cohen as the station inspector, he's just so he it's weird. At points he's, you know, the pratfalling type of character, but then at those points he's very like the straight man. He's just he's basically us as the audience going like, what are you talking about? Like, are you stupid? But yet, you know, he's a multi-layered character, and it makes me happy that he's showing that, look, I'm not just these characters from my UK comedy series, the Ollie G Show. I'm more than that. And he's finally branching out, you know, ever since like Sweeney Todd and Talladega Nights, he's branching off and showcasing that, you know what, I personally believe he's going to be a big, much bigger star than just like these comedies. Like, I think he's going to start branching out to like dramas, yeah, and whatnot.
I feel he has the chops to do dramatic work. He is a wonderful actor, and I just hope he's making smart moves with his career, not just being pigeonholed into one kind of one note types of roles and characters. I think my only criticisms of this movie are the actor who plays Hugo, Azza Butterfield. He's not the greatest of actors, but he is just a little boy, and I think this is his first movie. Chloe Moretz, who plays Isabel, who's kind of his counterpart in this movie, she's a better actor, definitely, and she really does carry him along throughout this whole movie, in my opinion. What are your thoughts on the two children in this movie?
To talk about now, Azza Butterfield, I actually didn't realize he played the younger Ben Talbot in the Wolfman remake. You know, I think the younger version of Benicio del Toro in the beginning. And he was also in the movie The Boy in the Striped Pajamas back in 2008. He's the actual one of the main kids in it, which is kind of strange. I didn't remember him at all. He must look completely different now. But yeah, he's like, I guess you could say the weakest link, but he still has the sweetness to him. And he's kind of like the Charlie Bucket, where you know, the film is centered around him at first, but you're kind of more interested in the guy that he's looking up to, or like wants to know more from. So like, instead of Willy Wonka, you have, you know, Ben Kingsley's character, George Méliès. You know, so that's more interesting to me. And he's just, as they say in the film, he fixes things. And that's ultimately like what he realizes he's good at. He's fixing this man. And I love that about that. But, you know, like you said, he's a kid actor. You know, he's better than others. But, you know, when you have someone next to him, like, you know, Chloe Moretz, you know, she, I don't know, like, she's just amazing. As usual. And I mean, sweet, but funny, but like kind of like wants to be like a Nancy Drew, even though it's before Nancy Drew.
Yeah. There's definitely this Nancy Drew, like, I want to get into an adventure type of.
And I love that. You know, I mean, I, you know, it's cute, but at the same time, it's not annoying. I mean, you know, for story's sake, you know, it's a 2-hour movie. She has to become involved sooner than later. So she, you know, when he asks her, like, can you help me out, they become bonded right away, as opposed to, you know, a TV series where it would take a while. But I understand that you have to get the plot going. Yeah. So she's kind of like, she's bored. And that's really ultimately why she wants to help this kid out who she knows nothing about. She doesn't even know where he lives, you know, and she's willing to help him. And I like that. It's cute. It's really what kids do. You know, when we were little kids, we trust other kids. Why wouldn't we? We don't have we're not old and bitter like we are now. We're like, oh, like, well, this kid needs my help. Oh, the hell with him.
I don't know how bitter. I'm not that bitter, I guess. I remember when I saw on Twitter someone tweeted out that Azza Butterfield will have a good career playing Cillian Murphy's son in a movie one day, because he kind of does look like Cillian Murphy, like
a little bit.
Yeah, in the eyes, they have that same kind of blue eyes and that kind of stare. And I was like, yeah, I can see him playing his son one day in a movie.
Yeah, he has some striking eyes. That's the selling point for his character. When you see the sadness in his eyes or the joy, it's there in the eyes. And he acts very well with his eyes. So I think that's, you know, hopefully it'll get better with everything else. But right there, he's got that, you know, oomph that a lot of actors wish they had, like where you could just like say more with your eyes without saying anything at all.
Yeah. There's a lot of talks for Oscars for this movie. Actually, the only Oscars I could see is probably Sacha Baron Cohen as Best Supporting Actor as the station inspector, because I think he is that good in this movie.
What about Ben Kingsley, though? I thought he's also pretty fantastic. And you see, like, you know, at first you're thinking he's one type of character, and then he, you know, when we see the flashbacks.
Yeah.
And also I think the makeup work.
Yeah, he actually does look young.
Yeah, it's scary, actually.
It doesn't look horrible. You know, I buy the fact that he is like 30 years younger during those flashback scenes.
Yeah, him and his wife, you know, especially Helen McCrory. I was surprised with that too, because, you know, they have wrinkles. They're older actors. But I was floored by it because, you know, considering what we're used to sometimes with like X-Men. Last Stand or whatever, when we see really bad faces. They look like plastic. This one didn't. They, you know why? Also, they were moving around. They were acting. They were, you know, joyous. And, yeah, I believe that they're 30 years younger.
Yeah, and also, like, just – I guess also with the special effects, sticking in Ben Kingsley as George Malaez, like, seamlessly it cuts into these movies, you know. For a split second, I do believe that Ben Kingsley is playing this actor. I mean, this filmmaker. Same thing with Helen McCrory, as well as his wife. When the scenes where she's into these movies as a young woman, I felt that was pretty well done as well. I don't know about Best Picture. I mean, this is a really great film, but my criticisms of it is that it is a slow burn, but I feel it is a deliberate pace. Do you see this being a Best Picture contender?
This feels like in the world we live in now, with the Academy doing 10 films, you know, more or less. I could see this if they had 9, you know, perfectly strong ones in, and then they needed a 10th, maybe. But I see many technical awards for this.
Yeah,
you know, any costuming and all that, but I don't see it. It's a great movie. I loved it, but I don't see it as being, you know, above other films that personally, you know, should be in there. But you never know with the Academy. It's a Scorsese film, so sometimes Scorsese gets in, you know, much more easier than other filmmakers.
Yeah, because he's Scorsese.
Yeah.
We all didn't like Bringing Out the Dead, I guess.
No, I
like that movie. That is a pretty good movie.
Yeah, like, we both liked it. So, but yeah, I mean, you know, I mean, with Scorsese now, like, you know, when you look at his filmography, you know, he's been all over the place. But, you know, like you said earlier, he's known for violence.
Yeah.
And no, it's true. I will agree with that. Like, when I think of Scorsese, I think of, like, kind of like how Tarantino did it also with himself, like where it's extreme violence out of nowhere.
Yeah.
But, and this one, it's more like, you know, there's extreme sadness at points in this film. So I think he replaced it like where when people die or people like lose something, it's like just sorrow in people's eyes and like, you know, like these scenes where you're just like devastated. And I think like now, like the older he's getting, doesn't mean he's going to sit back from violence. Like, you know, I'm not sure exactly what he's going to do next. You know, how does Scorsese, you know, take time off? He does a documentary about George Harrison or something. So, I mean, I want to see I want to see him do another kids movie.
Yeah.
I really do.
So would I. I mean, he's really good at, surprisingly, like doing like era movies, you know, like this was made in takes place in the 30s and it feels like the 30s. Even something like the Aviator, you know, that feels like it is in, you know, the 30s and the 20s, 30s and 40s as well.
Right.
I never thought Scorsese would be really that good at doing stuff like that, but surprisingly, he is.
Well, it's weird with Scorsese. When you think about it, like, I don't think of it as a, you know, a film of its, you know, of what time, but like even Goodfellas is, it goes through so many years of time.
Yeah.
And, you know, but when I watch it, I don't think of it like that. I don't think of it based in the 60s, you know, but we see the 60s, 70s, and the 80s, like in the span of this film. And when I look at it, you know, thinking about it now, I'm like, oh, wow. Yeah, that actually, he has done it before. But now with The Aviator and this, there's so much, I guess you could say, you are transported into that world with something like Goodfellas or Casino. That's not the important part. It's like the actual characters or you know, like, you know, it could take place in any time, even though those are basically true stories, you know, like trumped up. But you don't need to be in any time. Like, that could have taken place, you know, now. Yeah. And it'd still be a good crime epic.
So I guess you're recommending people see Hugo this week. I recommend people see it this week.
Yeah, definitely big recommend. Yeah, just also seeing Christopher Lee in it too was great.
As a somewhat scary librarian.
Yeah, well, because I think and that shows you that it was filmed in England because he never leaves England.
Oh, really?
At his age right now, like supposedly even with The Hobbit. He said, like, he'll do it, but he doesn't like flying.
Yeah.
Especially now. And he's at that age right now. He's like, I don't have to go everywhere anymore. So usually he'll be like, look, if you want me in a movie, come to me. And, you know, 9 times out of 10, oh, wait, it's Christopher Lee. I will go to you.
Yeah.
You know, like, I will film it. So, but like, we saw at the end, and like most of this film was filmed, like, in Pinewood.
Yeah.
Which was great.
They did a bunch of the newer Star Wars movies. Those were shot in England. Mm-hmm. That, so... That does make sense. I didn't know that he doesn't leave England.
Yeah, it's weird. He used to, you know, of course, and like I know he really loves New York City hoagies, like Subway sandwiches. He loves them. Like a friend of mine met him, and yeah, he loves them to death. Like whenever he would come to the States, New York City, got to get a big sandwich.
I'm just picturing Christopher Lee eating one of those big sandwiches going, a hoagie with his amazing voice.
Could I have some extra, you know, dressing? Okay, Mr. Lee.
But he is really great in this movie as well. I actually really enjoyed Richard Griffiths in this movie as playing kind of one of these background people who kind of just hang out in the train station a lot. He was actually pretty good in this movie and very delightful.
He sold the newspapers, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. That's the thing. Even the background characters, they feel like they're of this world. And they make me want to, one, read the book, and two, watch more classic films. You know, and I think ultimately that's really what, you know, Scorsese wants from people, like, watch these films and, you know what, read the book too, because he's had this option for like 4 or 5 years now. So
yeah,
glad he came through.
Yeah, I was reading in an interview that his daughter wanted him, and I'm quoting his daughter, "Why can't you make a good movie?"
Well, you know what? You know, according to his daughter now, I think he finally did.
Exactly. But I find that funny. You're telling Scorsese, why can't you make a good movie?
I'm sorry, honey.
which movie do you think is going to make have the bigger box office, Hugo or The Muppets?
I think The Muppets will, because, you know, with the onslaught of, you know, ads and, like, actually, a funny story. When I was in the city yesterday, and when I was walking up 34th Street from when we left the theater, I saw Kermit the Frog singing with Elmo outside of Macy's.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Man. I don't know what they were filming for, but they were doing something. There was a crowd, and I'm like, what's going on? And I closer I got, I saw Elmo, and I heard Kermit. I'm like, oh, there you go. So they're banking on it, but I think with all the positive buzz, because I think it's still 100%.
Yeah.
On Rotten Tomatoes, I think it's gonna do really well, and it makes me happy because now like the Muppets have been slowly building their brand back, and you know Brian Henson is actually really good as Kermit as a more of an improv puppeteer or Muppeteer if you want to say. But I'm happy. I'm just waiting for the day to see the Asylum version of the Muppets called the Puppets. Yeah.
Oh man. Well, you haven't seen the movie yet, but there's actually a moment in the movie when I could say, yeah, I could see an Asylum version of this movie. And you'll know what I'm talking about when you meet these characters, and I'll just say that.
Okay.
I actually hope Hugo does well. I really do hope Hugo does well, and I hope people see this in 3D. I'm not really sure how well it's going to do this week, but either way, see Hugo or see the Muppets and you'll have a great time at the movies. That's for sure. All right, so let's wrap up this episode of Movie Night. Where can we find you online, James McCormick?
You can find me at cineawesome.com, also criterioncast.com. And, you know, usually the majority of my stuff, you know, if you want to see me tweeting about Tom Waits looking like Ron Perlman, check out my Twitter account at Fistful of Media.
And you can follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/Rudy_Obias. That's RUDIE_OBIAS. Shakya.com, autorcast.com, and everything that is Rudy at RudyObias.com. So on the next episode of Movie Night, we're going to be discussing Coriolanus or Shame, or probably both, but most likely just Shame. That's going to be a complete 180 from Hugo, but we'll discuss that film. Thank you so much for listening to our show. Goodbye. Hello, everyone. Welcome to Shakya Presents Movie Night. I'm your host. My name is Rudy Obias. Joining me for this episode, he is the host for Fat Guys at the Movies. He's also a writer for FilmSchoolRejects.com. Kevin Carr, thank you so much for joining me on this episode of Movie Night.
Thank you, and I'd like to thank your audience for all the applause that they're giving me right now.
Yes, or they're turning off their iPods right at this moment.
Like, this guy, click.
Like, screw this guy. I have to hear him for one podcast already that I don't like. So the movie that we're going to be talking about in this episode, one of the big movies coming out this Wednesday, I believe, and it's kind of, I guess, a return to form, or this is The Muppets. This is the first Muppets movie since 1999 with Muppets from Muppets in Space.
Well, the last first theatrical, because they did stuff like Muppet Wizard of Oz and stuff like that,
which was like 2005 or 4, I believe. So the Muppets are still around, but the last Muppets movie was in 1999. As this movie suggests, culturally irrelevant at this point. And just to give a brief synopsis, this is from IMDb. With the help of three fans, the Muppets must reunite to save their old theater from a greedy oil tycoon played by Chris Cooper. So, Kevin Carr, what are your thoughts on this new Muppet movie? Are they culturally irrelevant?
Are they culturally relevant now, or have they? Are you saying they're culturally irrelevant once sort of the last Muppet movies kind of waned in quality?
Well, with this new movie coming out, will they be culturally irrelevant?
No. I mean, I think they. Here's the thing. I grew up with the Muppets. I was like 6 or 7 when they started the Muppet Show, and I watched Sesame Street, and I watched the leap from Sesame Street into the Muppet Show, and then from them going to the big screen in 1979. And it's such an integral part to my childhood. I mean, this is equivalent to, you know, Looney Tune cartoons in a lot of ways, where you watched a lot when you were a kid. When I was a kid, and I remember when Jim Henson passed, I was in high school, and I mean, the entire school was distraught by this. This was a big deal. So we have high school kids really, really, you know, saddened by when Jim Henson passed. And of course, you continued with more with the Muppets and he passed the legacy on. So I, like many other people out there, I have a great affinity for them and a great history with them. I was very reluctant to get into the hype leading up to this because there was so much online hype. And,
oh, yeah.
You know, online hype is great and all for it's in its own little vacuum, but it really doesn't have an impact on greater society. Either that or, you know, Scott Pilgrim would have been the highest grossing movie.
We can bring up Scott Pilgrim and Attack the Block, movies that get so much hype on Twitter and with people like us in our profession. But in the real world, that really doesn't mean anything.
Yeah, and so I was reluctant to get into it, and I'd heard some of the there was a little bit of drama behind the scene because Frank Oz didn't like that he had a different idea, and so there's a little bit of bad blood going on there. So I tried to go in as clean as I could, and I went. Fortunately, my rep provided me with enough seats. I brought the entire family, kids, all three kids, and the wife, and. I love this movie. I fell in love with it all over again. I think it captured what made the Muppets great in the 70s with their just the ability to be silly and stupid and goofy and crazy, but also to have a lot of heart without being overly preachy and to really, you know, bring the audience along into the film. And I think they also had a nice mix of meta jokes. Mm-hmm. And self-referential humor and throwbacks to the old movies and even breaking the fourth wall, which they do in the original Muppet movie.
Oh yeah.
As well. So it wasn't this was they made meta before meta was meta. that works in this movie. They don't overuse it. They come really close to overusing it a couple times, but they don't. And there are only two complaints I really had about the film. The first, there's as much as I love Chris Cooper in the movie, his musical number.
Yeah.
They could have lost that. That felt like a grab from the early 80s or early 90s or late 80s that they throw in a movie and you'd be like, yeah, that was that you'd watch that years later and be like, that was a mistake to put in. And then the other thing is, even though I respect Jason Segel for what he did to get this on the screen and helping write the script and all, I really, you didn't need his character or Amy Adams' character to even make it work.
Yeah, I mean, when Jason Segel hosted Saturday Night Live this past Saturday, the Muppets were there and they were excited that they were also hosting Saturday Night Live, but they weren't. They were just making this cameo. Kermit the Frog actually makes this point by saying, oh yeah, when people want to go see a Muppets movie, they say they can't wait to see that human in it.
Because that's true. And I think the way movies are made nowadays, that you couldn't just have a cast of Muppets.
Yeah.
You know, even back when they did Muppet Christmas Carol, you had Michael Caine as a human anchor to the whole thing. Whereas, and that was kind of the beauty of the original Muppet movie is, yeah, they had Charles Durning playing Doc Hopper, but he wasn't the anchor. It was the Muppets. Oh, and all these other people who are also in it. This one, I think it had to kind of fill this bean counter bottom line of saying, well, who are the stars in it? Well, it's the Muppets. Oh, no. Kermit the Frog isn't a real star. We need an actual human being. And they even – and at least I forgive it for this because they kind of make a joke of it in the movie where they're like, well, the Muppets aren't enough to do a TV show. You got to have a star in it.
Yeah. Well, if you look at it in that way that they get that TV show because they have nothing. The network has nothing else to put on at this time. Mm-hmm. That they but they're not culturally relevant is why they don't get this TV show at first. I can see why they have the human element in this. And actually, I think the greater story here though is the relationship between Jason Segel's character and his brother Walter. I think that was probably the main thing of the movie. And you do really need Jason Segel. And I mean, I'm glad that he's not in it as much as I think he would have been if he was just the star of this movie. I do think Walter is the main character of this movie more so than anything else.
Yeah. Well, because Jason Segel and Amy Adams, they disappear for 40 minutes.
Yeah, and they make a joke about that pretty early on. And when they leave, we really don't miss them. I feel that they're throwing in for kind of the adults of the movie because I can see the arc of the movie going from when they're with their relationship. I really enjoyed this movie. I like you, Kevin, was really reluctant to buy into all the hype around it because I just got so saturated with all these trailers that were coming out, these mock trailers that they were putting out. By the second trailer that they put out, I was already burnt out on the Muppets. and just hearing about the Muppets week in and week out, you know, for work. So I was kind of reluctant. How could this really live up to the hype? And I was surprised. This really does live up to the hype. This is a very enjoyable and entertaining movie. It definitely has its flaws. This movie could have been a little tighter in its screenplay and its story, but I think it's all forgiven because it's just so entertaining that you just can't help but enjoy the songs and enjoy the movie and enjoy the pace of the film. And when I watched it a couple days ago, theater was packed with kids, and the kids seemed to like it just as much as the adults, even though I know that they didn't catch all the cameos that were made in the movie by celebrities. They didn't know who these celebrities were. But it seemed like they liked it anyway. There was this little boy sitting next to me who didn't even want to sit in his seat. He was just so engaged with this movie that he was like, I'm just going to watch this movie right now. And like, you know, but he didn't make a sound. He wasn't being very ruckus. He just didn't want to sit. He was just really into the movie. And I just had this impression that this is probably the first time he saw a movie.
Well, and it's also what we forget. Even you're younger than I am, but you're still an adult. I mean, you're not like 18 or something. But I think that there's a lot of people who are younger. If you talk to like teenagers now, sort of the Muppets didn't exist for them because it's funny. I have a friend. I just had lunch with a friend the other day, and she was wanting to show the Muppet movies to her kids who are ages, I think, 12 and 15. And they're like, they're puppets. They're kids. And they have no concept of who the Muppets were and how important they were and how socially and culturally relevant they were because the Muppets just kind of waned in popularity. Mm-hmm. They you know what it's like? The Muppets are like the stopwatch that Belloc holds up in Raiders of the Lost Ark, where he says it's just a throwaway thing. It's just a worthless item I bought from a street vendor, but he buried in the sand for 1,000 years and becomes priceless. That's what happened to the Muppets. The Muppets disappeared. They still did some stuff on Disney, but Disney kind of was like, well, this isn't a viable property right now, and we can just do direct-to-DVD stuff. And they disappeared for 5 or 6 more years. And, you know, this is us unburying them from the sand. And will they get overused? Yeah, they'll do a sequel if this does well, and they'll do a couple more movies. And, you know, even though I never thought in a million years they would even have a chance to host the Oscars, they'll definitely show up at the Oscars.
Well, there's already talks about rebooting The Muppet Show on TV.
Yeah.
Like bringing back The Muppet Show, which I didn't grow up with. My connection to The Muppets were actually the Muppet Babies, you know, 1986.
Oh, please don't say that.
And so that's for me, being a generation under you, I think, that's where my touchstone for The Muppets were The Muppet Babies. And then I got into the Muppet movie, like the 3 Muppet movies that came up before that.
You're forgiven.
And actually, I like Muppets Take Manhattan because there is the entry into Muppet Babies in that movie.
That's where they started. It was just this throwaway bit and became ragingly popular when it showed. Yeah.
And then 2 years later, they had the TV show, which I love to this day.
Is that Muppets Tonight? Or are you talking about the original TV show?
No, the Muppet Babies.
Oh, okay.
And so that's what I got into, my entry into the Muppets. And so that's what I know the Muppets were. So when I went into, I guess, the hype that was surrounding this, I didn't really have that nostalgic connection to it. But watching this movie, I mean, I think this is a pretty good companion to that first Muppet movie because it plays out the same way. Instead of Kermit meeting all these people for the first time, he's just getting these people back together for the first time in a very long time.
Well, also, if you watch the original Muppet movie, they go back. They have callbacks specifically to that, not just Sweetums not making, you know, getting left behind, but also when he says, "Oh, this is the standard rich and famous contract." By the way, did you know? Because that was the whole thing. Orson Welles at the end of the Muppet movie is like, "Bring in the standard rich and famous contract." So they're referencing that exact contract that they made with what is it called, Worldwide Studios, which was the fake. And also, if you watch the original Muppet movie, at the very, very beginning, Robin asks Kermit, he goes, "Is this the real story?" And Kermit just kind of goes, "Well, it's sort of what happened." So already there's the framework to say that what happens in the Muppet movie is not canon, let's just say.
Well, even the villain in the first Muppet movie, and the Muppet movie was this fast food mogul, you know,
Doc wanting Hopper, to, yeah.
And then in this one, it's an oil tycoon. So you still have this villain who is driven by money and greed. And there's a lot of cross-country voyage journeys in this movie, much like the first movie. Great gags. I love the fact that the Muppets were stuck in the late 70s, early 80s, and there were so many callbacks to the early 80s, namely for the 80s robot in this 80s. Movie.
Was that you, or was it somebody else who said that they want on Twitter said they wanted to see a battle between the Waffle Bot and the 80s robot from the Muppets?
Yeah, that was me.
I would love to see that.
And when I first saw the 80s robot in this movie, I was like, oh, I want to see him fight Wafflebot from Harold and Kumar 3. yeah, I love this movie. Well, what did you think of the music in this movie? There's actually a lot of criticism that these songs aren't as memorable as what we would usually get, like namely Rainbow Connection, that there's really out of the new batch of songs in this movie, they're not as memorable.
Well, it's hard to capture that lightning in a bottle. I think they're right. The musical songs are not as memorable. But then again, if you watch The Great Muppet Caper, which was made just a couple of years after the first Muppet movie, those songs, I watched it the other day and I'm like, oh, I remember this song. This is catchy. But I couldn't have told you the songs on my own for that movie. Same thing with Muppets Take Manhattan. I don't think I can name a song in that movie. So there was sort of that. You can't recreate that. You can't recreate the Rainbow Connection and Moving Right Along and I Hope We Go Back There Someday and that kind of thing. Those are such iconic songs, but I'm okay with that because the songs they had in the movie, they worked. They were totally reasonable and they fit in the framework. But what they did to balance that out is they used popular music, which the Muppets have always done. And to the point, they don't do it as much even in the first Muppets movies. I'm not exactly sure if it's a rights issue, but if you go back to the old Muppet show, they do covers of songs all the time. And those are the great – and as including their – as well as the ones that they write for the original. But there were throwbacks to decades. You know, they used Built This City on Rock and Roll and all these – I think they used a Cars song at one point when they were driving. And these are old songs. And what's great about it is – those are catchy enough. I was watching – my kids were running around after taking them to see it. They were running around all through the entire weekend singing the songs from this Muppet movie. Even if it was We Built the City on Rock and Roll, they're still singing the song from a Muppet movie.
Yeah. Well, are you familiar with the TV show The Flight of the Conchords that came out?
Yeah, I've never watched it, but I am familiar.
Yeah, the guy who – one half of Flight of the Conchords actually wrote a bunch of the songs for this movie.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a big fan of Flight of the Conchords, the TV show and the band and the comic duo. And so I didn't know that going into this movie. And while I was watching it, I just thought a lot of this movie – a lot of the music does sound like Flight of the Conchords, even the way that they're shot, like the music video-ness of it. And I was surprised to see, oh, one half of Flight of the Conchords wrote the songs for this. That's why they're like that. And I think it fits perfectly for this new generation of people who are getting into the Muppets or even just people who are revisiting it. It feels fresh. It feels new, even though it's something from the 70s.
For as much as everybody is saying, as it is getting complaints about, well, the music's not as good as Rainbow Connection or whatever, would you have been better off with Kanye West writing the music for this? Or Will Smith coming in and producing it and putting his son in it and then writing all these songs to it? I mean, trust me, this could have been a lot worse. There could have been a lot worse, awful decisions in the music of this movie that what we get is a gem, even if they're not 100% memorable. Yeah, I mean,
the movie and the music is just very wholesome, but not irritating. It's not cynical. They make a point in this movie about we live in a cynical world these days. Things have to be edgy. That's why they have the Muppets in this.
Yeah, the Muppets.
And also the TV show that is taking place – that is the most popular TV show that you know, you have to be a TV show like this to be on TV now, to be this edgy.
Yeah. Punch a teacher.
Punch a teacher.
My wife, who's a teacher, loved that concept.
The Muppets aren't cynical. And I think that's what's so great about them, that they're just honest and sincere. And you just feel that while watching this movie. Even if you are the most cynical person, you can't help but kind of melt while watching Muppets. That said, Armin White hasn't come out with his review of Muppets yet.
Oh, so. I'm sure. What does Armin White do when there's a 50% rating on the tomato meter?
I don't know. I don't know. Well, right now, it's tracking at 100% on Rotten Tomatoes. So.
Well, yeah, it's going to be well reviewed. The thing is, I'll tell you, you're talking about how the Muppets aren't cynical. The Muppets. I wrote a piece for Film School Rejects this week, and it's the top 10 things we learned about the learned from the Muppets and stuff like Love is Blind. And I have clips from all the shows for each one of those. One of them I say is the Muppets taught us you should never be above making fun of yourself. You should never take yourself so seriously that it supersedes reason.
Yeah.
And the clip I chose from that is when Mark Hamill's gargling Gershwin from the old Muppet Show from 1980.
Yeah.
And although I'm sure Mark Hamill's high as a kite when this was going on, it was still a great episode. But I think that's all encapsulated by if you watch the original Muppet movie, when there's a final confrontation, the showdown in the old Western town between Charles Durning, Doc Hopper, and Kermit the Frog. You know, it's very serious, and they're coming there, and they got the frog killer from the coast, and everybody surrounding him. They got the two sides. And at one point, Kermit just goes, "What the heck's the matter with you?" And that is the essence of the Muppets. Like, why are you taking yourself so serious? It's a silly little lark. We're having fun. We're here to entertain, do songs and dances, and make people happy. And that's always what the Muppets wanted to do.
So, I guess lastly, and I guess spoilers for the Muppet movie, so listen with caution because we're going to spoil some elements of the movie. What was your favorite cameo in this movie?
Oh, gosh. Favorite cameo.
Because I could say my favorite cameo in this Muppets movie was Jim Parsons from The Big Bang Theory.
You know what? That's one way up there because that we just giggled at that. Not just because it was Jim Parsons, but how he presented himself in the cameo.
Yeah, I thought that was just perfect. Like, it's with the song "Am I a Muppet or Am I a Man?" And then seeing the man equivalent of this Muppet, Walter, is Jim Parsons wearing the same type of suit.
And it makes total sense. You watch, you'd be like, "That's totally them." Like, that's totally
it would totally be Jim Parsons. And I thought that was like my favorite cameo in the whole movie was that.
My favorite cameo, I'd have to say, probably aside from that, because that was a genius cameo. Probably my favorite cameo was the kid from – I don't even know his name. The kid who plays Manny from
– Oh, yeah, yeah. From
Family. Because he walks in with Whoopi Goldberg, Selena Gomez, and they walk up and they don't even know who he is. And I'm like, that's genius.
Yeah. And it's funny that you didn't even know his name
either. I don't know what his name is. Because he's a little kid.
I love that moment because Kermit's like, oh, Whoopi Goldberg, Jim Parsons. Hey, you.
So I thought that was that probably is one of my favorite cameos. I mean, there's some other great cameos in it. And that's another thing that's so beautiful about, and that stuff you said, the kids aren't going to get all those cameos.
Oh no.
Both kids aren't going to recognize like Donald Glover or something like that. Or what was the guy from, who's the Politico, the bald headed, skinny, weird looking political guy who was one of the, he was just one of the call guys.
Yeah, Jim Carville.
Carville, yeah, James Carville. No child is going to recognize James Carville, even though he looks like a freaking Muppet on his own. But those are things that the adults are like, oh, hey, that guy. And there's just like weird 6 degrees of separation that are going through all the cameos. And the same thing happened with the cameos in the first movie. I remember if you look at the list of cameos, a lot of them I didn't recognize. In the second movie, Great Muppet Caper, Peter Ustinov has a cameo. I don't know who that was.
Well, going back to that first Muppet movie, I don't think kids knew who Orson Welles was.
No, they're just like, that guy looks serious.
And wouldn't even get the joke that he is the head of this movie studio. Orson Welles hated Hollywood, so that's why it's kind of funny that he's the head of this Hollywood movie studio. I love the cameo Neil Patrick Harris, again, making another cameo like he did in Harold and Kumar, but and I thought it was just funny. Oh, Neil Patrick Harris is in this movie. Dave Grohl, the drummer from Nirvana and the lead singer of Foo Fighters, he has a cameo in this, which was pretty funny.
Oh yeah, yeah. It's and the one that surprised me the most was Mickey Rooney because I literally said, I think audibly, I said, "Oh my God, is he still alive?"
Yeah. Or
he is.
Alan Arkin in this movie as the tour guy, or Ken Jeong as the host for Punch Teacher.
Punch Teacher, yeah. Or, yeah, it's a it's a well-constructed. I want to say one thing about, you mentioned the show, talking about the show coming back. I think this is a time where I think that could actually work, because they tried, like with Muppets Tonight, and they tried to bring it back on the Disney Channel. Part of the thing is because Disney's or the cable's gotten so disparate now. There's so many stations, so many things that if you're not on that big launching pad, major station, you're on like this, you know, way up the dial. Even if you're on ABC Family or the Disney Channel, that's such a limited audience. I think, though, with the way television is, with music shows are back on the air. Because back in the 90s, they didn't have a whole lot of music shows, because variety shows is what the original Muppet Show was based on, and those don't exist anymore. But you do have musical performance shows, and I don't want to see the American Idol version of the Muppets, but I think you can get away with a non-series, you know, a not continuous storyline that just has production numbers and stars. And I think it could work. They're going to have to update it a little bit, but I hope they don't update it too much if they do it.
Well, in this day of the internet and how smaller attention spans are in the age of YouTube, something like The Muppet Show that could be condensed with every 5 minutes, there's always something new. I can easily see the Muppet Show being relevant again, because it just works for the internet. Just small little snippets of comedy and musical numbers. Sure. So I guess one last thing. What do you think is going to be the bigger hit this weekend, Hugo or The Muppets?
First of all, I hope to God that Twilight will take its 75% drop that it's due. In historically, and it will not win the weekend. So I'm hoping that if I were to put money on it, I'd say The Muppets. I think Hugo's a harder sell. I think Hugo is a more expensive movie, which actually we've seen at least this year and in this economy, fewer people actually going to the theater and paying an extra $5. And then if you're expecting them to take their kids, oh, I can go to The Muppets and take my family of four. I can go to The Muppets for $40, or I can go to see Hugo for $80.
Yeah.
And I think that I think that's going to factor in. So I think The Muppets are going to be bigger. I think it has a wider appeal. It's more mainstream. They've got great movies this week. I look at this week as Hollywood apologizing for last week.
Also, that said, that I feel spending full price for this movie, like seeing it at any time of the day, you'll get your money's worth simply because there's so much entertainment with the Muppet movie itself. You also get a short film from Pixar at the beginning of this movie. Which is really entertaining. You get a new Toy Story short at the beginning of the Muppet movies, which kind of freaked me out of this kind of because I didn't know we were going to get a short film.
But, you didn't know that? Oh, yeah. It's small fry. It's a big deal.
It freaked me out in terms of Disney synergy, because I'm watching a Muppets movie, but then there's a Toy Story Pixar short film. It for me, it was like the moment when I first saw Who Framed Roger Rabbit and Donald Duck and Daffy Duck in the same scene together. Freaked me out.
it is one of these things, because it's this Disney movie with two properties that Disney acquired in one big package.
And like Toy Story being the biggest of the Pixar, and it's a great short. It's like I will love if every Toy Story short just was Pixar short was a Toy Story short. I love that aspect of the movie. It's definitely worth your money this weekend. All right, so let's wrap up this episode of Movie Night. Where can we find you online, Kevin Carr?
Well, you can go to fatguysofthemovies.com and see my podcast, or listen to my podcast and movie reviews. You can go to Film School Rejects and check out the Film School Rejects Guide to the Muppets, because there's a lot of great Muppet content up there this week. And you can also, if you want to hit me up and tell me I'm an idiot or I'm a genius, or you just want to say hi, you can go to twitter.com/Kevin Carr.
I will be tweeting you are an idiot right now.
Yes.
And actually, I don't know if I can say this because I write for Shockya.com, but there's actually so much good content on Film School Rejects. I do recommend that site completely.
Thank you. I like to take full credit for everything.
As editor-in-chief, Neil Miller, you sound different now.
Exactly. He's just a figurehead.
And you can follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/Rudy_Obias. That's RUDIE_OBIAS. Shakya.com. We have good content too. And AuteurCast.com, which is my podcast on filmmakers and mostly art house type movies. All right. Thank you so much for listening to our show. Goodbye.
Manamana. 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 Manamana.